Hi again, everybody, and welcome to Emron's Podcast, episode 118. It's Monday, October 13, 2008. This episode is called Shock Mount, and the album art for the episode is of my shock mount, which is essentially a rubber band-like holder for a microphone, and it's intended to absorb any shocks so that if somebody bangs the desk or table or whatever, that those sounds won't get transferred to the microphone. Now, I bought it so that I could take it out with me on the road to whenever I'm interviewing somebody out and about, but I just haven't had a chance to test it out, as I got it about 3 weeks ago. I've been way too busy. And this is my first chance, so I thought, oh, well, I'd give it a go before I actually, you know, like, rely on it. But I did mention this a long time ago and how it was taking forever to arrive. Well, obviously it has. But the other reason I call this episode Shock Mount is because of all of the shocks that the world has had to absorb over the past couple of weeks, with the world financial crisis. And I thought I would talk a bit about that today. I'm not going to get in any great detailed, explanations and stuff, because quite frankly, I'm not an economist, and finance and economics are not my strong suit. However, there was an article that I've come across which I think helps explain something that's going on. But before I get to that, I thought I'd talk a little bit about how it's affecting New Zealand and Australia. And the short answer is not all that much. The share markets have been down, as you'd expect, and the New Zealand dollar has, at one stage, plummeted dramatically against the U.S. dollar. It's recovered a bit since then. I think it hit a five-year low from memory. But the banking sector itself here is not at risk as it is, say, in the U.S. And the main reason for that is that the banks are really strictly regulated. Our main trading banks in New Zealand are actually all Australian-owned, apart from a couple smaller players, including Kiwi Bank, which is owned essentially by the people of New Zealand through the government. And those banks are regulated, and the odds of anything on an American scale happening in either country are really, really pretty remote. And partly because of that, Australia and New Zealand never had a depositor insurance scheme similar to the FDIC or FSLIC in the U.S. But over the weekend, Australia announced that it was going to institute a depositor protection program. And of course, New Zealand has now followed suit. And again, this isn't terribly necessary, except that it does make depositors feel better about leaving their money in the bank. And that's what they need, because the banks need the capital to be able to loan and do all the other things that banks do. And it does nobody any good if people start pulling their money out of the bank and hiding it in the mattress. So instituting this depositor protection scheme will, I think, help restore some confidence among just ordinary depositors in the strength of the banks. But the banking sector is strong and secure, at this stage anyway, in both Australia and New Zealand. There hasn't been a huge dramatic effect on either country, apart from the fall in the share markets and fluctuation in the exchange rates. They do predict that the general economic slowdown is going to result in a rise in unemployment in New Zealand from the current roughly 3.9% to about 5.2% over the next 12 to 18 months. But that's still below the U.S. That's still low by world standards. And if that ends up being the case, it's manageable. But we have an election about 3 or 4 days after the U.S. does, and we'll see what ends up happening as a result of that. It'll be interesting to see how things shake out in the end. Interestingly, the leader of the Conservative National Party, who's the leader of the opposition, and some people think he will be the next prime minister, although that's by no means certain, his background is as a currency trader primarily. And what's the fancy term they have for investment banker? Essentially, he speculated in currency at the start of his career. And he thinks that that makes him well-placed to deal with the economic problems. Other people think that that may not be the case, because people like him were partly responsible for some of this financial mess. So this is all just beginning to come out, obviously, as the New Zealand campaign just really starts to heat up. The campaigns have just launched, because the real campaigning can't start until a month before the election, which was this past weekend. So I'll keep you posted about all that as that develops. And of course, I'll be talking more about the New Zealand election in the weeks ahead. But today, I wanted to focus more on something that's happening in the U.S. And first, a little background. I received an email from Anthony it used to be Ashantina Lemon. Anthony, if you're listening, I've forgotten the name of your new podcast already. It's something about Transformers. I remember that. And so we had an email exchange, and also with Daniel Brewer of Dubious Intent and Callbox 7. And it was about this, well, part of it is an email campaign, but also a campaign among the right in America to blame the Clinton administration, the Community Reinvestment Act in particular, for the financial meltdown. And the whole thing just didn't sound right to me, I have to say. Only I hadn't had time to do any research into it. Well, Daniel thoughtfully provided a link to an article from the McClatchy newspapers. But this particular article, which is called Private Sector Loans, Not Fannie or Freddie, Triggered Crisis, I think that this article pretty much sums up the reality of the situation. And because some of you may get one of these screwy emails, or you may read one of these crazy articles, I thought I would take some time to go over it today, because I think it pretty much sums up the other side of the argument better than most of us could. Because let's face it, how many of us ordinary people have this foggiest idea what's going on? I mean, I know I certainly don't. I don't understand half of what's going on, and I also don't understand the reasons why they're doing what they're doing. But this article, I think, helps shed some light on this whole subject, particularly this latest campaign from the right. The article is called Private Sector Loans, Not Fannie or Freddie, Triggered Crisis. And I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'm going to read parts of it and comment on it. As the economy worsens and Election Day approaches, a conservative campaign that blames the global financial crisis on a government push to make housing more affordable to lower-class Americans has taken off on talk radio and email. Commentators say that's what triggered the stock market meltdown and the freeze on credit. They've specifically targeted the mortgage finance giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which the federal government seized on September 6, contending that lending to poor and minority Americans caused Fannie's and Freddie's problems. Federal housing data reveal that the charges aren't true, and that the private sector, not the government or government-backed companies, was behind the soaring subprime lending at the core of the crisis. Okay, now that's an important thing. What they're saying, essentially, the core of the argument is that it's the government's fault for lending to poor people and minorities. And there's a subtext to this, which I'm going to come back to, but I want to drive that home. They're blaming the entire crisis on government lending to poor and minority borrowers. Okay. Goes on. Federal Reserve Board data show that more than 84% of subprime mortgages in 2006 were issued by private lending institutions. Private firms made nearly 83% of the subprime loans to low and moderate income borrowers that year. Only one of the 25 subprime lenders in 2006 was directly subject to the housing law that's being lambasted by conservative critics. The, quote, turmoil in financial markets clearly was triggered by a dramatic weakening of underwriting standards for U.S. subprime mortgages beginning in late 2004 and extending into 2007. The President's Working Group on Financial Markets reported Friday. Now, conservative critics claim that the Clinton administration pushed Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to make home ownership more available to riskier borrowers with little concern for their ability to pay the mortgages. Now, the problem with that is that nobody associated with Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac can ever remember that sort of a directive. But here's the other thing. And I'm going to read the entire paragraph because it also tells you, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are actually words derived from the acronyms for the two companies. And this paragraph actually tells you what they stand for, because I bet most of you probably don't know. Because, the only reason I knew is because I used to be a real estate salesman years ago, so I knew about these things. Anyway, Fannie, the Federal National Mortgage Association, and Freddie, the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation, don't lend money to minorities or anyone else. They purchase loans from the private lenders who actually underwrite the loans. Okay, now that's an important thing. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac don't make loans. They buy them. And blaming them for private banks making risky loans is absurd. It's like blaming a car manufacturer because somebody drives without their seatbelt on. It's just nuts. But nevertheless, it's one of the things that the conservatives have been saying. And of course, there are a lot of reasons why successive governments, this goes back to many, many years, have been pushing home ownership among poor and minority people, because we all know that home ownership stabilizes communities. It makes them less crime-ridden. It makes them stable in general. It helps everyone if people own the homes that they live in. Unfortunately, through the 60s into the 70s even, there was a process by which banks avoided certain neighborhoods because they were filled with largely poor, largely minority communities. And one of the groups that the conservatives are criticizing so much, Acorn, was trying to get around that by preventing them from doing this redlining practice. And the federal government got in the act in 1977 when it passed the Community Reinvestment Act. And the conservatives are particularly harsh on that. They say that that's the cause of it. But it says, the article goes on to say about that. It says, Congress created the CRA, Community Reinvestment Act, in 1977 to reverse years of redlining and other restrictive banking practices that locked the poor, and especially minorities, out of home ownership and the tax breaks and wealth creation it affords. And it goes on, the CRA requires federally regulated and insured financial institutions to show that they're lending and investing in their communities. That's it. It doesn't actually force them to make it. It just make the loans. It just requires that they show that they're making an effort to invest in their communities, which includes, frankly, loaning to poor and minority borrowers. But this is an important part, too. The article says, conservative columnist Charles Krauthammer, or however you pronounce his name, Krauthammer, whatever, wrote recently that while the goal of the CRA was admirable, quote, it led to tremendous pressure on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, who in turn pressured banks and other lenders to extend mortgages to people who were borrowing over their heads. That's called subprime lending. It lies at the root of our current calamity. Fannie and Freddie, however, didn't pressure lenders to sell them more loans. They struggled to keep pace with their private sector competitors. In fact, their regulator, the Office of Federal Housing Enterprise Oversight, imposed new restrictions in 2006 that led to Fannie and Freddie losing even more market share in the booming subprime market. What's more, only commercial banks and thrifts must follow CRA rules. The investment banks don't, nor did the now-bankrupt non-bank lenders such as New Century Financial Corp. And Ameriquest that underwrote most of the subprime loans. These private non-bank lenders enjoyed a regulatory gap, allowing them to be regulated by 50 different state banking supervisors instead of the federal government. And mortgage brokers, who also weren't subject to federal regulation or the CRA, originated most of the subprime loans. Now, what does that all mean? What it means is that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac didn't create this problem. They couldn't have, because they couldn't compete in the open market to buy these so-called risky loans. There were others who were doing it, the so-called non-banks, who weren't regulated by the federal government. And that was at the root of much of the problem, not Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And actually, elsewhere in the article, it goes on to detail the percentages of these loans that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac bought, and the percentages were declining from roughly 2004 onwards. And you cannot argue that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were responsible for the collapse of the financial industry when they weren't the majority owners of these risky loans anymore. So what's going on here? And this is at the core of what I wanted to say about this. The Community Reinvestment Act was designed to help poor and minority people gain home ownership. The narrative that's coming out of the right is essentially a racist narrative, because it is saying essentially that poor and minority people don't deserve the benefits of wealth, essentially is what they're saying. And they are so hard on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac on this and blaming the Clinton administration because they can't outright say that black people shouldn't be allowed to own their own homes. They can't say that. But given the racist subtext that's been going through much of the Palin-McCain campaign in recent weeks, this is just another part of the same thing. And what I would hope is that commentators in America would start pointing this out, that there is a very clear racist undercurrent in most of the conservative talking points these days, and their overall goal is to prevent people from thinking kindly of African Americans in particular. And why would they want to do that? Obviously, because the Democratic nominee is African American. And anything they can do to create bad feelings toward African Americans, particularly, and poor people in general, because Barack Obama used to be a community organizer, of course, everybody knows this, they think can only help their cause. And I think that somebody has got to stand up and say to these people, the emperor has no clothes, and point out that what they're saying is simply not true. And that's my little effort today to do just that. Now, over the coming week, I'm going to be talking some more about issues, but from a slightly different and maybe a bit unique perspective. I'm going to be talking about some issues, like healthcare, for instance, and talk about it from a New Zealand perspective, or perspective of somebody living in New Zealand, and how some of the things that you hear in America from politicians and from the news ain't necessarily so. There are other sides to these issues, and generally speaking, Americans don't get to hear those other sides. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to talk about these things from another perspective. And I expect that these episodes will all be really short, but hey, you never know, because sometimes they don't quite turn out the way that I planned. But we'll see. But right now, I'm going to go over comments from, and this is from previous episode, episode 117. And first up was Anne, who says, on McCain, interesting read from Rolling Stone. And she provides a link. It's for the article called Make Believe Maverick, The Real John McCain. And on your latest acquisition, I now wonder, we, are you getting product placement commissions? You should. And I said, thanks for the link. I'd heard about the article somewhere, but just hadn't had time to look it up because I've been really busy. Sadly, no, I get no product placement commissions, but I'm for sale. I meant, of course, that the podcast is available for sponsorship. And next up was Nessa, who said, sounds like you had a good time with your nieces. I love playing Wii golf because I beat my husband. You would think that a Scotsman would play better. Ha ha ha. Glad you're back. And I said, if Robbie Burns reciting and haggis eating were part of it, you might fare differently. Seriously, we did have a great time with our nieces, and we'll probably host them again sometime. Hope you're having a great vacation. So, Nessa and her husband are actually on holiday as we speak. But those are the written comments for today, and right now I have a phone message.
Hi, Arthur. This is Arthur. I'm just calling to make sure that you don't lose your phone message because nobody rings your voice line. Bye.
Well, thanks for that, me. Now, I had said a long time ago I was going to do that if I didn't get calls. It happens that I looked at the calendar and realized that it had been more than 30 days since my last phone message, so I quick rang and it was still active. And, of course, now I've guaranteed it for a little while longer. But, you know, it's expensive for me to call the U.S., and it wouldn't hurt if you would call for me. Actually, if you don't want to leave a phone message, just call my listener line, 206-339-8413, and hang up. That's okay, because as long as you make sure that it plays through the entire message, you might wait a second and then hang up, because then I won't have to. Simple as that. And speaking of things that have been neglected, I noticed that my last iTunes review was September 27th. It's beginning to get a bit old and stale, people. Come on, get a move on. And also, in an upcoming episode, mentioned our nieces a minute ago. Our niece, who is at a summer camp in America for the past few months, is now home. And I hope to have her on fairly soon to talk about some of her experiences and some things she saw as a young Kiwi overseas. And but we'll see how that goes, because we're all very busy these days. Oh, one last thing I almost forgot to mention. I received an email from listener Bruce, who's temporarily in Russia, of all places. And he reported that the American consular officials there were really quite good about trying to help American citizens vote. And just recently, in the past week, I got an email from the New Zealand consular staff basically promoting the same idea, helping Americans vote and explaining how they can do it and those kinds of things. Which I thought was really good. Mind you, it would have been a bit better if they had started earlier, because the deadlines had already closed in some states by the time they sent the email. But, you know, points for trying. And I will be going over more emails in the week ahead, I'm sure. But that's actually it for this episode of the Amrins Podcast. I will be back probably several times this week, actually, with these short episodes. And until then, I hope you have a great week, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye. You can leave a comment on this or any other episode of the Amrins Podcast at amrinspodcast.com. You can send an email to me at arthur@amrinspodcast.com, or you can ring my U.S. listener line on 206-339-8413. This podcast is produced and distributed under Creative Commons license. Complete details at the website.